You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative talents at one of the world's great opera companies. For additional podcast interviews, subscribe to our RSS feed or visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Soprano Deborah Voigt, tenor Clifton Forbes, and stage director Jose Maria Condemi are backstage at Lyric.
The most difficult thing for me is a mental challenge, and it starts from the minute you wake up in the morning and you start thinking, oh my gosh, you know, it's 9 o'clock. I've got to climb this enormous mountain, and in this particular production, we mean literally as well, and we'll probably get to that. But for me, it's really a matter of not letting my head get in front of the game and not worrying about what's going to happen in Ozinkanita Nacht when I'm asking Bergena where we are in the first, you know, 2 minutes. That is the biggest pacing thing. And Miss Nilsson was right. You have to have good shoes. There's no question about that.
You remember when you were a kid and you wanted to play cowboys and Indians, or you were the knight rescuing the damsel? You had to put yourself in that frame of mind, because Jose has created the perfect observatory from an audience perspective. You're looking at it. Close your eyes sometimes and hear it and see that youthful, faraway fantasy land that you had as a kid where you used to go to escape.
When Wagner created Tristan, the technology that he needed to tell the story the way he wanted didn't exist. I mean, it was before electric light. So he really wrote a piece that only 100 years later could be realized. And what Hockney did, which I find very interesting, that he really took the story at face value and did a medieval storybook setting, which is a lot of what Wagner did with the original tale. I mean, he stripped down all the details and just had a basic story. So I think this production really follows upon what Wagner set out to do. So my job is really just not to interfere too much and just not have them do stuff that's unnecessary.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric. I'm Jesse Graham, Audience Education Manager at Lyric Opera of Chicago. For this episode, we're playing an audio transcript of the panel discussion from the Lyric Opera Discovery Series session on Tristan und Isolde. For those of you who may not be aware of the Discovery Series, it's panel discussions featuring singers, conductors, directors, and opera experts. We do one session per opera, and they usually take place a few days prior to the opening of the opera. The Discovery Series is open to the public, and it's a great way to get up close and personal with our artists. You can check out our website at lyricopera.org for dates, tickets, and complete Discovery Series information. We include all the Discovery Series sessions as part of the Backstage at Lyric podcast. And now, on to the Discovery Series panel featuring Deborah Voigt, Clifton Forbes, and Jose Maria Condemi. I'm your host for this session, and I hope you enjoy it.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to our Discovery Series session on Tristan und Isolde. I'm Jesse Graham, the Audience Education Manager here at Lyric, and I'm standing in tonight for Roger Pines, our dramaturg who's been called away on urgent family business. I do have Roger's questions, however, and I'm looking forward to posing them to our terrific panel tonight, Lyric's Tristan und Isolde, Clifton Forbes, and Deborah Voigt. Now, as we do from time to time in this series, we have an additional surprise guest, the stage director for this production, Jose Maria Condemi. Now, our introductions. Isolde is Deborah Voigt's sixth role here at Lyric. She's previously starred here as Amelia, Ariadne, Sieglinde, Salome, and most recently as Strauss's Empress last season. She triumphed as Isolde first at the Vienna State Opera in 2003 and then at the Metropolitan Opera last season. She's a Met favorite not only in Wagner and Strauss, but also as heroines of Berlioz, Verdi, Ponchielli, and Puccini. She's been hailed in innumerable prestigious venues, from the major houses of San Francisco, Munich, and Berlin, to London's Barbican Center and the Salzburg Festival. Highlights of Deborah's current season include Ballo in Paris, Fidelio in Vienna, Tosca at Covent Garden, and she can be seen on DVD in La Gioconda and heard on CD as Isolde, Leonora, Zenta, and Berlioz's Cassandra, in Wagner duets with Placido Domingo, Strauss and Wagner arias, and a recital of American songs. Our Tristan, Clifton Forbis, debuted at Lyric in 2000 as Tom Buchanan in The Great Gatsby. He starred as Tristan to open the current season at the Bastille in Paris. He'd previously sung the role at La Scala and in Geneva, Berlin, Vienna, and Los Angeles. The Geneva production has been released on DVD. Clifton made his Paris opera debut as Parsifal. He's closely associated with many other exceptionally demanding roles, from Florestan to Don José, Sigmund, Samson, Otello, and Oedipus Rex. In addition to many appearances at the Metropolitan Opera, other major successes include Sigmund at the Vienna Staatsoper, Otello at La Scala, and Mahler's Das Lied von der Erde, with numerous major orchestras, including those of Boston, Cleveland, and Toronto. Clifton's current season includes Fidelio in Barcelona, Die Walküre in Berlin, and Otello in Dallas. Argentinian director José María Condemi, who was associate director for Lyric's Così fan tutte 2 seasons ago, has many exciting projects in his future, including directing San Francisco Opera's Tosca and the world premiere of Don Davis's Rio de Sangre for Florentine Opera of Milwaukee. He is a former Adler Fellow in Stage Direction at San Francisco Opera, where he has directed Così on the main stage and other productions with the company's Mirola program and Western Opera Theater. Among his other major directing engagements are Louisa Miller in Toronto, La Boheme in Seattle, Don Giovanni in Cincinnati and Portland, Donizetti's Maria Padilla in Minneapolis, and Il Trovatore in Austin. A former Fulbright scholar, he's also a recipient of the Argentina National Endowment for the Arts Award. Please join me in welcoming Deborah Voigt, Clifton Forbis, and José María Condemi. Thank you so much for being here, all three of you. All right, in addition to his questions, Roger has provided me with his traditional 30-second synopsis. So let me first refresh everyone's memories about the story of Tristan und Isolde. Before the opera starts, the knight Tristan kills Morolt, the fiancé of the Irish princess Isolde. Curtain up. As King Mark's nephew, Tristan escorts Isolde by ship from Ireland to Cornwall, where she is to marry King Marca. While still on board ship, Isolde asks her maid, Brangaena, to prepare a death potion for Tristan. But the maid substitutes a love potion instead. Both Tristan and Isolde drink it and fall passionately in love. Act two. That's what happens. It gets better. Act two, at night, with Marca supposedly off hunting, Tristan and Isolde yield to their passion. The two are caught by Marca and the treacherous Melot, who wounds Tristan. Act three, Isolde travels to the now delirious Tristan, who dies as she approaches. Marca, Brangaena, and Melot arrive and watch grief-stricken as Isolde sings her famous Love Death over Tristan's body. Did we? Yes. All right. So let's start. Deborah and Clifton, were these roles that you dreamed of singing from the time you were first aware of this opera?
No. And only because I never envisioned myself ending up singing this repertoire as a young singer. I came to opera, as many of you know, because you've seen me here way too many times over the past years. I came to opera rather late in my life and in my vocal study. And so I was busy singing roles by Mozart and Weber and some early recital music when I was introduced to Wagner. And I was initially introduced to the more lyric roles, which were part of my early days as a Wagnerian. And so the idea that I would end up singing Isolde was something that I really never imagined. And even at the time that it did present itself, it was a bit premature in my sort of plan for things. You, darling?
Is this on?
Yeah.
What was the question?
Tell me, when you were 5 years old, do you think when I grow up, I want to sing Tristan?
Yes.
I'll rephrase the question slightly.
No, I didn't. Is this short because I'm short, or do I just sit like this?
Sorry about that.
Can I touch this? Is this okay? Help is, that's all right. We got it. We're good. Evidently, we don't.
Tenors.
Is that really what it's like? Yeah, it's going to be a long session for you, Deborah. I'm afraid.
No. No, it'll come in Act Two tomorrow somewhere.
Oh, thank you.
Even better.
That's right.
Yeah, no, we've done a lot of singing together, so and she constantly heaps the abuse upon me, so it's nothing new. No, actually, yeah, when I first heard this, I thought, I want to sing that. Wow. And it was... the first recording I heard was Ludwig Suthaus. Wilhelm Furtwängler was conducting, and I heard the Act Three, and I thought, this is inhuman. And there's a whole opera before this, you know. But yeah, initially when I heard it, I connected with it on some sort of visceral level, I suppose you could say.
Wow.
So, I wasn't five.
Yeah. Oh, no?
Six. But.
Okay. How about you, Jose Maria? Has directing this opera been a particular goal for you?
Well, I wouldn't call it a goal. I mean, I'm Latin, as you can tell. So I'm sort of usually more interested in, very small Mozart. But I did work on this production 5 years ago in San Francisco, and I sort of fell in love with it. Yeah. And when this opportunity came about, I really was looking forward to it. And, it is a daunting task, and it's long, and as we know, it's not a story in the conventional sense of it. You know, it's not a sequence of events or something, somebody does something that makes something else happen. You know, there's a little bit of that, but it sort of forces you to revise the way you approach the work.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
I bet. Deborah and Clifton, when a genuine dramatic voice appears on the scene, opera companies tend to respond immediately by offering you the great big roles. This is a three-parter. Were each of you offered this opera years before you finally decided to do it? B, how did you know when you were ready? And C, what were the stepping stones in the Wagner repertoire, or in any repertoire, to help you, led you up to taking on this role? And again, this is for both of you. You'll have to decide who goes first.
Well, being the tenor, I'll go first.
That's just because you won't remember the questions. Oh, tomorrow is going to be a long day.
That was one of your better ones.
Thank you.
Right. What was the question? No, joking. Actually, I kind of have to disagree just a little bit, because I don't think most opera houses anymore, and this is where I become very controversial, which is what I am to begin with. I don't think a lot of opera houses anymore know what a big voice is supposed to sound like and what it is and what to do with it. So, and that seems to be the case with, not only houses, but certain people who are in the powers that be.
they don't remember orally what Vickers sounded like. They don't remember what Delmonico sounded like. They don't remember, you know, these like Giacomini, these big, beefy sounds. Mm-hmm. And when they hear them now, in a way, they're almost, it almost reads to me as a type of confusion. What is that? You know, mm-hmm. That's too dark. That can't be a tenor, you know. And on the first half of that question, I've said my soapbox thing. There we go. But I do find that once you step into this repertoire, that it's a road that has nowhere to turn around, because there are so few people who actually sing this repertoire. If you can, you will. And you can't really step back from it, because what it does is your vocal, your technique becomes, I won't say different, it becomes, what's the word I'm looking for here?
It can take away a certain amount of flexibility.
Yeah.
Doing sort of roles that might require coloratura or a certain amount of lyricism become more difficult.
Lighter things mm-hmm. are no longer really, and by the same token, you don't really want to go back to that. Not that those things are not, you know, wonderful as well, but you've had an extremely intellectual as well as emotional and heartfelt musical epiphany and experience. Thank you. No, well, jump right in.
The roles are so full, too.
They're so full.
I mean,
full.
When you sing Tristan and Isolde, and you go back to look at some of the operas that are more like a Bohème, not to put down Bohème in any way, shape, or form, but when you've spent so much time with that kind of dialogue and those kinds of mental images and ideas and emotions, it's a little difficult to sort of step back and not be a little bored, a little removed from some of the pieces that you were introduced to as a young person, as a more lyric voice type.
And you got to remember, things like Otello, the entire role is not even as long as Act Two of Tristan. So we're just getting warmed up, you know, and he's going home, so.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Actually, there's a great question in here about that very topic. In fact, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit to both of you. I promise I'm going to come back to you because I've got a great one for you. But pacing. Pacing. Now, you're talking about what a tremendous marathon this piece is. And with so much of this to get through, how do you pace yourself so that you survive to the end of this opera? And I'm also curious about whether or not Wagner helps you out in any way, or whether he's just totally merciless.
And it helps Isolde.
He helps Isolde.
Yeah.
Now wait a minute.
You get to do all your hard stuff right at the beginning, and then sing lovey-dovey, and then go to your dressing room for an hour,
and come back and sing the hit tune. But anyway,
that's right.
What was the question?
How do you pace yourself?
Oh yeah, pace myself. I think at this point, well, that's the thing. My problem with this kind of role, I just did Gioconda at the Met, and she's very long and complicated as well. Not like this, but complicated. And I was speaking with Petra Long, who's playing my Brangaena. Does that sound like a soprano or what? Yeah. The most difficult thing for me is a mental challenge, and it starts from the minute you wake up in the morning and you start thinking, oh my gosh, you know, it's 9 o'clock, I've got to climb this enormous mountain, and in this particular production we mean literally as well, and we'll probably get to that, but it's a real mental game. And you spend most of the day just trying to talk yourself into staying in the moment. And, you know, when you're laying on that chaise waiting for the curtain to go on, you can't think about that you have 5 hours ahead of you. You have to think about what's happening in that moment. And when you've had as much experience as we've had being on stage over the course of, you know, years of well, anyway, by now you've learned vocally where you can afford to give more and where you can't, and that sort of becomes built in. For me, it's really a matter of not letting my head get in front of the game,
yeah.
and not worrying about what's going to happen in Ozinkanita Nacht when I'm asking Bergena where we are in the first, you know, 2 minutes. That is the biggest pacing thing. And Miss Nilsson was right. You have to have good shoes. There's no question about that.
I don't pace myself. And I don't mean that as a joke. And I don't... I think each singer approaches a role differently. I've done this particular role almost 70 times. The first 10 or so were lived in sheer terror. And as she talks about, you can't, if you can put your mind out of the way, I'm giving you an opening here, which for a tenor should be easy. I gave you two graces in your little speech. I could have popped in, but I didn't. No, if you put your mind out of the way and let your body take over, your body knows what to do. If you've spent your time learning the role and melding the role into your physicality, into your body, it remembers, it knows. And sometimes even when you're ill, if you can just shut your brain down, your body will know. So for me, when I start that show, I'm not thinking about pacing. It's like Debbie said, it's every moment. The Germans have a phrase that's Dasein, which be is loosely translated. And with Wagner, and I'm sure for Debbie, as I saw yesterday in rehearsal, there are moments when you no longer see Debbie. You see Isolde, because she is being at that point. And that's not to say there aren't moments when we have to put one foot back in the dressing room on a particularly difficult phrase, but we spend the majority of our time in that moment. And if we're in that moment thinking about the moment that's going to happen 4.5 hours from now, well, it doesn't work that way. So in terms of pacing, I guess I just have to say you can't. And if you run out of voice, you run out of voice. That's part of the bargain. That's part of the deal. You give 100% every minute you're out there. And because if you rob from the first act to give to the third act, then you're not doing the first act justice either. You know, that's why I was saying earlier, people like Vickers and Giacomini and those guys, they gave it all the time. They were walking that edge, and sometimes, you know, it wasn't pretty. I'm not being light about this at all, because this is art. But I don't think you can create each and every night. We recreate not the same character, but a new character. And on that particular night, if you're 70% vocally, by golly, you give 100% of that 70%. You know, you do. You buy tickets to come watch us. We give you 100%. And if we run out before the end, I'm sorry. But you give everything you have, you know?
So don't try and say I only got 70% of my tickets worth.
That's right.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we'll print that on the back of all our tickets. Clifton says, if I run out before the end, sorry.
I don't.
No, I don't think we're too worried.
No.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about the music. This is kind of a long opera. It's got a fair amount of music in it, although the more you listen to it and the more familiar with it you get, in some ways, the less music it has in it. But regarding the music here, when you're first getting to know this piece, This is a three-parter this time, okay? I'm going to start with you, Jose Maria. When you're first getting to know this piece, what sections of it grabbed you from the start? Are there any sections then, this is part B, are there any sections then that only revealed their meaning to you gradually over time, or that maybe you're only now starting to understand and appreciate more? And C, especially, did you have any epiphanies during this particular production?
Wow. Yeah. As a listener, I was always fascinated with the beginning of Act 2, the horns and how atmospheric it is and sort of sets the tone for what's upcoming. I knew the Liebestod, of course, and then I actually directed the narration on the curves many times. So those were, you know, the entry points for me. You know, I guess the epiphany is always finding out how masterful Wagner is at playing with the audience in terms, you know, we can talk for hours about the Tristan chord and how it resolves at the end, but it really takes you on this journey where it primes you for climax that only comes 4.5 hours later. And, you know, the more I get to know the piece, the more that shows. Mm-hmm. And it's quite incredible, actually.
Yeah, it is remarkable. He's the ultimate tease, Wagner, isn't he?
Yeah. Kind of unnerving, actually, at some point, right?
Yeah, really masterful.
He just won, you know, particularly, you know, the love duet. It's always interrupted by something, the arrival of Melot or King Marque, just as it's about to resolve and keeps you wanting.
Until the very end.
The very end.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Deborah?
I think probably the narrative in The Curse is probably what grabbed me to her, because it kind of sums up, you know, what's going on in her head and where she's coming from, and the frustration and the anger and the hurt and the love that she feels all at the same time in this incredible piece of music. Epiphany. I am constantly finding bits to it that touch me in a way that I hadn't expected. I'm always finding things that I find more difficult than I thought they would be, or easier this time around than they were the last time. Interestingly enough, the fact that Isolde has so much time off before she sings the Liebestod is really not beneficial. And I find that to be more obvious every time I sing it, when one would think, well, why is that? You've just had a nice rest. Well, that's the whole point. You've had time to sit in your dressing room and crochet or do your Christmas cards or whatever, you know, it happens to be going on at the moment.
Are you staying character? Sorry,
we had this chat.
Yeah.
I know you're all disappointed that I'm not sitting in my dressing room thinking I'm still on the ship, and I'm so mad. What am I going to do? Wait a minute, I took the love, love him, I love him. No. Yeah, so you have your head wanders. You're not as focused as you were at the end of it. So it's very hard to get back up to performance level, even in terms of your body temperature, and you know, you get into a groove on stage and things start to, you know, heat up and move, and then you go in the dressing room and like, okay, let's see. Well, Clifton's almost dead. Well, it's almost time to go out there again. You know, I mean, it's just like, and it's just enough time to get cold, and you have to go out and sing the Liebestod.
What do you think? Clifton, any epiphanies?
What does that mean?
You use the word yourself.
I'm joking.
Don't give me that.
I'm joking. Yeah, I know. Don't let the Southern accent fool you. I do find it. This is funny. The further north I go, when I open my mouth, the estimation of my IQ drops about 50 points. Okay. But when you go overseas, they think it's so charming. You know? I love her. Actually, you know, for me, initially, the best thing about this whole opera was the Liebestod. And I thought, ooh, I get to lay on stage and listen to this time after time after. But no. But I kept thinking, man, I really would love to be able to sing that. I really would love to be able to sing that. And then all of a sudden it dawned on me, dummy, you get to sing it all through Act Two. But it was about, like I said, the same point. It was about after 10 performances when I realized, I was living in fear, so I wasn't enjoying the music. And once I started to enjoy the music, I realized, oh, I'm singing the Liebestod. So for me, that was the epiphany.
Jose Maria, this is something that's fascinated me about this piece for a long time now. In the course of the love duet, Tristan and Isolde, they're looking incredibly deeply into themselves. And they say a lot of things to each other. Some of them are practically unfathomable. But one thing that keeps coming up over and over again is this day and night.
Mm-hmm.
Can you sum up that discussion?
Yeah.
For us? Go ahead.
Well, they talk for 36 minutes, is it, about doing?
Something
who's
like that.
Counting?
About day and light.
47.
But, you know, that's...
Depending on
who's
conducting.
Yeah. Well, that's the challenge about Tristan, is that, as we know, Wagner, he set out to do what he called the simplest, most full-bodied opera, yet, you know, the proportions are daunting. But he, that's the whole Schopenhauer stuff. He was very much into Schopenhauer philosophy and sprinkled it all over the piece. So Act Two, the love duet, is highly symbolic, and night and day represent philosophical terms that are connected to the story in the sense that when they talk about day, they are talking about all the stuff around and the circumstances that prevents them from being together, Kim Marke and the court and the backstory. And then night or darkness represents death, you know, which is what they feel is going to let them fulfill their desire to be together. And that's challenging because you can't really play day and night. You can only play their desire to merge and blend and disappear. So that's what they're talking about. They're not really talking about, it's not a lovey-dovey duet. It's a philosophical dissertation.
And they're already talking about death, even, you know, early on in their romance,
yeah.
If you want to think
very
about
early
that.
On.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they actually start talking about death right after they drink the potion, although it gets more and more, they really go more into losing consciousness. At the end of the love duet, the act one, they say, I only see you. And then as they progress in act two and three, they keep talking more and more about dissolving into the land of darkness and finding release in death.
Wow.
So it's all about philosophy. It's not a story in the conventional sense.
Yeah, there's many, 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 many layers underneath that. What about King Marka? Now, he's got this long monologue that begins about 2 minutes after the end of the love duet, after he's caught them together.
Mm-hmm.
And this concentrates everything right on this character of Marka for about 10 minutes. And it's a remarkable moment in the action. I mean, it's a showstopper, really. What's going on emotionally here, and what do we learn about Marka and how he views his nephew, Tristan?
Well, he's trying to understand betrayal. I mean, he's the most human side of the king. And he's struggling to understand why Tristan would betray him. It doesn't quite make sense. So, it's kind of human condition at its basic.
You want to throw anything in there?
No, you're right. It's just, I... being on stage,
we're spending the first.
We're like exhausted by the time
the
King Marka scene begins, and it's really hard for us. Maybe I'm speaking for myself, but
no.
You're so tired, and he comes on, and it becomes very slow, and it's very poignant, and it's very beautiful, but you just want to sit down.
And those first
and
couple of
cut, moments, cut this. And it's terrible. I know it's terrible.
The first couple of minutes of his duet, we're probably sitting there going, I'm going to kill that conductor. I'm going to kill him. Because he added 45 seconds in terms of tempo or something. You know. But she's exactly right.
Ooh. Wow. Now, I want to remind
you. I told you all that, but it's true.
Well, and then there's the challenges of the physical production, which we can get into that.
Oh, yeah, I hope we do a little bit.
Well, it's a beautiful set, as you will see, but it's
see
a very steep rake, and that, I don't know how you guys do it, to be there for 4.5 hours.
The floor is very steep.
Very steep. It's like being
this is a major understatement. I mean, it's the worst one I've ever worked out in my life.
It's actually illegal
now. No, seriously.
It actually is, yeah. It is.
20 years ago when it was built, the regulations were different. Then OSHA stepped in and set designated levels for rakes, and this is now considered an illegal rake because it is so steep.
So you're seeing something really unique.
Yeah. But it's a great set.
It is.
It is great, yeah.
From your perspective, it's fabulous.
Yeah. From your feet's perspective, from my feet,
well, then I managed to break a toe, like the second day of rehearsal. So, yeah, we're having fun. We're really enjoying it. Yeah.
Okay, now back to the production for a second. Okay, we've listened to you complain now about the rake, and I understand completely, having seen it myself. It's acrobatic. Watching them, it's like Spider-Man or something. Okay. But what else about this production? What do you think are the strengths of this production, as it's presented here? Roger says, in terms of the kind of music, the kind of movement that you're creating for your singers within these sets, and the basic character of the stage picture in general, what are your most important priorities? This is for you, Jose Maria.
Let me tell you what I find. Why I like the Hockney production. And we know when Wagner created Tristan, the stagecraft, the technology that he needed to tell the story the way he wanted didn't exist. I mean, it was before electric light. So he really wrote a piece that only 100 years later could be realized. And what Hockney did, which I find very interesting, that he really took the story and at face value and did a medieval storybook setting, which is a lot of what Wagner did with the original tale. I mean, he stripped down all the details and just had a basic story. And I think this production really conveys that, and also the way Hockney uses light and how the interplay light use actually build up to that final climax that happens at the end of the Liebestag. I'm not going to give it away, but that's a beautiful light use that actually conveys visually what happens with Isolde at the very end. You can't see because you're dead, but and it happens literally on the last 10 seconds of the opera. Visually, you will see exactly what happens musically and with the story. So I think this production really follows upon what Wagner set out to do. So my job is really just not to interfere too much and just not have them, you know, do stuff that's unnecessary.
I've heard a little bit about this ending, by the way, and you know, I'm glad you didn't give it away completely, but I've heard
it's really just a like you, but it really sums up that moment beautifully.
Yeah. I wish I could see it.
It's behind you, just
turn around.
Kind of along those same lines, this is this may seem like kind of a pedestrian question, but it is a little bit of a mystery. I've always thought that Isolde dies of operatic causes. This actually, there are much deeper reasons for this, but I'm curious, what exactly does Isolde die? I mean, what's happening here?
She dies of unbewusst Höchstlust.
Unbewusst Höchstlust. I think it's just she just leaves. I think she's done.
She dies of bliss, of unconscious highest bliss.
Right. It's not. I don't think it's necessarily just restricted to the idea of operaticism, but I think she. You know, they talk about it for hours ahead of time, and I think that's just what happens. He's gone, and he had invited her to go, and she's going to go, and simply wills herself to be gone.
And it works.
Well, I mean, if you expect to see me pull out a razor blade and slit my wrists and die in front of you, no. But if you
have you ever had to do that?
No. You know, this is only the third production I've ever done of Tristan and Isolde, so I don't have nearly the experience that Clifton has. But the productions I've done have all, you know, been basically the same. It could be left up to your own interpretation. You know, what do you think is happening? It's not something that's necessarily going to be spoon-fed to you. Hmm. You may have to use your own sense of belief in what you've heard them say between each other for the time leading up to that moment.
What do you think is happening, Clifton?
When she dies?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sleeping at that point. I don't know.
Oh, you're already dead. You don't care.
I actually did that one night, and I snored, which wasn't good. But it was only in rehearsal, so. But my soprano.
I'd love to know who the soprano was.
I'm not going to tell you.
Oh, come on.
And it was one of those things where you knew you were snoring and you go like that, you know? It's kind of unfortunate, but no, I have to say, along in terms of what Jose Maria, I keep thinking that'll go further away, but the thing that she's also talking about is Jose Maria has given us his guideline, his tour, mentally and emotionally. And then he allows us to incorporate our artistry into his direction. So it's not so much... what was the question?
I'm sorry. What's that she die off?
Yeah. No. So it's not so much... how it happens is that when Debbie does it, she just... What was the production you were talking about where they went out onto the edge and...
Oh, the one in Munich where they step aside from the bloody end where everybody pretty much dies and they're in another world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, you know, it's, you can... I mean, the La Scala production is all this literally bleeding...
From
here. Did you do the production?
No.
Okay. She's bleeding while she's singing the Liebestod, and it's completely opposite approach of what we are doing. But that, you know, I don't think Isolde dies is the point of the opera. I think it's about
the way she lives.
Yeah, it's, you know, merging into oneself. Yeah,
it could be said that she doesn't actually die.
She might not die, actually.
That she doesn't die, but that she's gone.
And in fact, Wagner makes it very clear. I mean, you know, there's eight corpses left at the end of the opera, at least in this production. So there's no attempt to shy away from physical death or blood, but Isolde doesn't die that way.
It's something beyond the physical.
She transcends, yeah.
But that's what's so difficult about this piece. It's so hard to get your head around that, you know? Like La Boheme, where she...
Right.
La Traviata, or, you know, any of the obvious...
He doesn't jump off of a parapet.
No, exactly.
And you guys read about Wagner's private life and the fact that he wanted to do a piece where he could, on stage, somehow achieve this ideal of love that he could not... That clearly he didn't live by. He's like, he had a wife and a mistress and another one that was upcoming, so... This idea of what's unachievable was very important to him in this piece, and you know, so the answers to all these questions are kind of you cannot answer them.
I knew it wasn't an easy question. Speaking of you know, razor blades and such, and we touched a little bit on a couple of other productions. Any really unusual, outrageous productions of this opera you've been involved in? These are always fun to hear about. Especially when they compare favorably to Lyric's production.
Well, the first one I did was in Vienna. It was a Günter Kramer production, and it was very modern, and so it was not loved by the Viennese terribly much. But I had a costume that I was boned within an inch of my life, and I had a 17-foot black tulle train. 17 feet. And that's not a big stage. And, you know, it was a very small acting space. So I rehearsed in this thing. And, I mean, it had to be staged into my movements. If I turned this way, it would not be possible for me to turn that way because my dress was there. And so everything was very much organized and choreographed around this dress. And we did the opening, and you know, the audience booed terribly, but that's kind of normal for new productions in various places. Anyway, so the second performance, I go out on stage, and I'm walking around, and I'm like, something feels weird. Something's not right. Well, I got halfway through the first act, and I'm still, you know, something is not right. And just before the curtain went down, I looked down, and someone had chopped 7 feet of my train off and hadn't told me. And I went storming back into my dressing room, and I said to the dresser, "What happened to my dress?" She says, "What do you mean, Frau Voigt? What do you mean, what happened to your..." I said, "My dress is shorter." The head of the theater had decided that he didn't like the length of my dress, and he had it cut off without telling me. Like I wouldn't notice, thank you. It's like somebody just chopped 7 feet of your tail off after rehearsing in it for 6 weeks. And, well, it was back on for the next performance. Let's put it that way. But I'm sure you have one better than that, with all the ones you've done.
Okay.
Twist your arm.
It was Berlin. And it's kind of... quickly, a two-part story. The set was... If this were the set, they had a giant piece of latex running this way and a vacuum system attached behind. And they vacuumed all the air out so the latex would form to whatever was behind it. Okay? We're in Act Two, the love duet. Oh, wow. And I'm sitting there, and Barenboim's in the pit, and I'm looking down there, and Val Trautmeier's sitting over here, and she's miles older, and I'm thinking, this is the coolest thing ever. You know, this for me, you know. And I look at her lovingly, and she's looking at me like this, and I look in the pit at Maestro, just glancing, and he's going,
oh no.
And I realized I've not been singing for a page and a half. A little too caught up in the moment right then. I'm serious. Well, I get back on track. We finish our big love duet, and then we sit into this hollow in the cliff rock kind of thing, and the entire latex membrane blew up. like a balloon popping. It just went... We're sitting there looking at each other, just laughing our heinies off. You know?
You're lucky you had your hiney on. Yeah.
Barenboim's in the pit going, whoa. And here comes King Mark. He's laughing so. Yeah, it was, there you go.
Oh, man. Wow, thanks for that. Yeah. And the show went on, I take it.
It did. Right? We did not stop. Yeah,
you didn't stop.
I can't help but comment that you've sung every measure you've ever had to sing with me. What's up with that?
I don't know.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm jaded.
All right. I've got a last one for all of you before we get to the couple of questions from the audience. And this is kind of a general one, but I think it's one that everyone here would find useful. What do you hope your audience will come away with after a performance of Tristan and Isolde? Now that leaves you a wide open playing field.
Well, I suppose the idea that love can be defined in a lot of different ways, and the experience of love, and you know, that it can be something that doesn't end when you do, and that it can transform into something else and, you know, sustain you, even though that person may not be there or may not ever be there. You know, maybe just that, I think.
Jose Maria?
To me, it would be kind of a more aesthetic thing. You know, we live in such a fast-paced, quick reward world, you know, we can text and order things online, all of that. Such an amazing experience to go see an opera where you have to wait 4.5 hours for the climax. Mm-hmm. And I think that's wonderful. Just give it a chance.
Clifton?
All humor aside, really, I think that this music is such a paradox in terms of tragedy and triumph. And when you walk out of that theater, it's almost like you just want to walk out feeling, in a way, the release
that it gives you at the end, just experiencing that, you know, in terms of your everyday life, that this is supposed to be fun. I mean, art is experiential, but art is fun, and music is fun, and we're having a blast up there, and we hope you have a good time with it as well, you know?
Thanks. Thank you. I had a couple of questions from the audience. First, for Deborah and Clifton, this is for someone experiencing a Wagnerian opera for the first time. Ooh. Are there any, and this is big, are there any key focal points you recommend focusing on? And I think if I can add a little bit to this, I think, you know, musical high points, key moments in the drama where you think everything pivots that can make this thing come alive for a first timer.
Yeah. You remember when you were a kid and you wanted to, you know, you played, whether it was cowboys and Indians or you were the knight rescuing the damsel, you had to put yourself in that frame of mind. And you have to sometimes close your eyes and listen and create that picture in your mind. Because Jose has created the perfect observatory from an audience perspective. You're looking at it. Close your eyes sometimes and hear it and see that youthful, faraway fantasy land that you had as a kid where you used to go to escape and escape for the next 4.5 hours. Don't endure. Escape.
I would recommend a good cup of coffee. And just, you know, people have preconceived ideas about Wagner. Oh, it's going to be a really long night, and it's going to be very complicated. And of course, many of the comments that we've made tonight have just, you know, reaffirmed that. But, yeah, I think have a sense of fun and try to imagine the frustration that this woman feels and the sort of shyness that he has in dealing with her and you know, just moment by moment, and thank God for English translations. Be glad that you're living in a day. Seriously, I mean, you know, a lot of theaters fought that for a long time, and I remember singing Ariadne for the first time at the Met without the titles, and nice performance, and then the next time I sang it was with the titles, and to hear people laughing and really able to really get in the moment it's really brought the art form to a whole new level. So don't be afraid of it, and you're seeing some, if I include myself, a very talented cast, a conductor. I believe it's his first Tristan. It's a beautiful production. There's much to see visually and orchestrally. The sounds are beautiful, so I think you'll have a good time.
What do you think, Jose?
Oh, I was thinking, you know, you go see a Hockney painting at the Art Institute and you get a, you know, whatever, minute or 45-second glimpse, and it's one. And in this production, we have three sets, like 1, 2, and 3, and each light cue makes it look like a completely different painting. So you're going to see, I don't know how many light cues we have, but let's say 200. 200 Hockney painting, seated, and hearing beautiful music and beautiful sounds. So just, that's another way of looking at it.
It's great. Here's one for you, Jose Maria. What is the most challenging aspect of directing singers in a Wagnerian opera? And here...
This humor, 6 hours a day.
Yeah.
Now, I think for me... Hi.
Just pretend they're not here.
No, it's like, you know, as a director, you want to see, you want to see, you know, what's going to be before it is. You know, I want to see... before the final dress, what it's going to be. And of course, I can ask. I mean, Cliff and I have been having this back and forth. Every time we do Act 3, he comes to me and warns me that he's going to mark, meaning not sing full out, but also emotionally. And I understand he can do that. I mean, it's literally draining. But at the same time, I struggle because I have to see, you know, where it's going to go. And I trust him 1,000%, you know. So it's like finding, you know, restraining myself from the expectation and knowing that it's going to get there where it needs to get. And also trying not to exhaust them physically by repeating too much. And
he's been really, I have to thank you for that, because they're just, I mean, for me, it's the most daunting role that I sing. And throw in the fact that the stage is very difficult. Jose Maria has been very, very generous about showing us where we have to go, telling us what he thinks is going on emotionally between us or individually, and then letting us go home and process it. And that always works best for me, regardless of what the difficulty of the set or the role. I've never found it terribly beneficial to repeat and repeat and repeat, because we're people, we have to think about things and sort of live with it.
But that's why this thing about cliche, you know, because I read, you know, when I prepare for this, you read about the challenges and how long it is and how hard, and then you start getting ideas that it's going to be hard, that it's going to be challenging, and then you find out that it's actually, it is. But it's also not as hard as you think. I mean, you know, we had an amazing run of Act One the other day, and I didn't do anything different, but, you know, you guys...
No, but you let me go home and think about it.
No, I know. But, you know, you read that when Wagner did the opera, they had 77 orchestra rehearsals, and then they... Yeah, but then after that, they decided that you could not play it. That it was unplayable. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you read that and say, oh, my God. And, you know, we've come a long way, and, you know, we did it in 2 weeks, and we're going to be fine. So trusting.
Does anybody in here know how many Tristans they had before somebody finally could sing it? Anybody? Was it something like 8 or 9 who quit and quit and quit and quit and quit? And then the guy who actually sang the premiere died a week later.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Died. Boom.
Well, they're not paying us enough. I don't care what it is.
Yikes.
But I do have to interject here, because we hadn't had really opportunity to do so. He is, without a doubt, the most singer-friendly director that I've ever worked with. He understands that it's not only about the production, but it's about the music. And what he does with the production enhances the music, supports the music. It doesn't distract. It doesn't take away from the music. It doesn't go contrary to what the music is there. So kudos to you.
Oh, thank you.
Wow, that's wonderful. And wow. I think on that very nice note, I want to thank the three of you.
Thank
for
you.
Coming and being with us.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.